What's really going on in the heads and hearts of the humans around you? I'm Mads Grummet, journalist, entrepreneur and startup investor.
And I'm Sabina Reid, psychologist, speaker and media commentator. And this is Human Cogs, a podcast about the universal experiences that really matter and the candid conversations we need to have to share them.
If you like Human Cogs, we'd love you to hit subscribe and please leave us a star rating.
That way we can keep bringing you more stories from extraordinary ordinaries to help us all do human well. Today's guest is Fergus Watts, recently appointed CEO of the Reach Foundation, ex-AFL footballer and founder of Australasia's largest independent marketing agency, Bastion.
In this conversation with Fergus, we discover how a question asked by Jim Steins 21 years ago sparked a lifelong commitment to being true to who he was, living out his own values, and now paying it forward by scaling preventative mental health programs to thousands of young people across Australia.
If you've ever asked yourself, who am I, without the roles and labels we all attach to ourselves, or if a young person in your life is asking these questions now, then this chat has some gems for you. Okay, Fergus, as an entrepreneur, an investor, a champion of youth mental health and now CEO of Reach Foundation, I said to Mads earlier, it feels like you really could be the love child that Mads and I never had because it's this combination of mental health, entrepreneurship, business. We share a lot of the same passion, so we're thrilled to have you here. We know that you first attended Reach as a participant when you were 15 years old. Can you introduce us to 15-year-old Fergus?
Yeah, well, thank you for having me, for starters.
Welcome, son.
15-year-old Fergus. Well, I came from a beautiful family. I was born in the UK and we all moved over and you know, my parents had a business that had its ups and downs and at 15 was probably going more up than down. Went to a great school, had great friends, all that sort of stuff. Was desperate to be a professional footballer. That was my passion, was footy. But like any 15-year-old, I was trying to figure out who I was, you know. And that's why Reach, in many ways, changed my life. Or certainly opened up new ways of thinking about who I was as a 15-year-old, you know. So 15-year-old male, you've got the masculinity, you've got the bravado, you've got all the rubbish that goes with that. And as a young man trying to figure out how to be a real man, you know, and all the vulnerability and everything else that goes with that as well. So I was someone just trying to figure that out and walked into a Reach workshop when I was 15 and sort of serendipitously Jim Steins called me up on my chair in front of 500 young people and he said, who are you? You know, and that was kind of where it all started.
What did you say?
Well, I fluffed the answer and we still to this day ask, it's how we start our Heroes Days at Reach, is asking, who are you? And, you know, I kind of answered like in the same way that, you know, I'm Fergus or, you know, I don't know, I'm this, I'm that or, you know, whatever. And he really pushed me on it. And, it, you know, it got me thinking as I sat down. I thought, geez, I've never been asked that before. I'd never thought about it. I'd never really sort of been pressed on that in any way. And that was kind of the magic of the Reach experience for me, was that the Heroes Day, at the end of the day or towards the end of the day, I found myself with a microphone in hand again talking about something that was much more vulnerable and emotive and sharing something much more real about me. And Jim and Jules, who were facilitating on the day, said, that is who you are, you know. And it's not just that bit. It's the bravado-filled, joking, you know, hyper-masculine male at the start, and it's the vulnerable, emotional, more open, connected young man towards the end, and everything that goes in the spectrum of being me. And that was one of the great experiences for me, because I really got some juice from that, you know, in that it is okay to be all of me. And that was the experience that Reach gave me and ultimately led me on to you know, do whatever I've done in my life, because I always tackle everything from a position of complete realness, and it's okay to be open and okay to be very sort of honest about exactly who you are and where you're at. because it's the only real way to connect with anyone or do anything meaningful, you know, and it's sort of all started there at Reach on that day.
So how would you answer that question now? You just said you're all of those parts, and it's actually something I talk about a lot. We're all made up of multiple parts, and often those parts, some lie dormant, others are louder, some of them we're proud of, other parts we're more shameful of, some are in conflict with each other, others mm-hmm. are in unison. What do those parts look like now for you?
Look, it's continually... or continues to be not the easiest question in the world to answer. But my position is that I'm a man, or I like to think I am a man, of great character, great integrity and substance. So of all the other stuff around the outside, I'm far from perfect, make mistakes a million times a day, some big, some small, emotionally have ups and downs like everyone else. I am just a stock standard normal bloke. But if I can continually act with substance and character and integrity in everything I do, then I'm pretty comfortable being me. That's sort of the underlying of everything that I like to sort of focus on and everything I like to think I'm about.
Which is more about values. And most people, when you ask, who are you, they want to share their roles. I'm a mother, I'm a psychologist, I'm a speaker, I'm a facilitator, I'm a sister, I'm a daughter, blah, blah, blah. But you're letting your values lead the way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Being defined by the job I do is not where I want to be. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've seen very consistently in building businesses and playing football and, you know, you get defined by that. And that was, you know, my short football career taught me some amazing things. And, you know, I was a first-round draft pick wanting to be the next Wayne Carey. And 4 years later ended up with a busted-up leg and multiple operations and, you know, looking for a job. And what it taught me was that it was very okay to fail, you know, and fail on a very public stage. But up until that point in my life, I'd been known as Fergus Watts, the first-round draft pick, Fergus Watts, the future footballer, Fergus Watts, you know, it was all connected to footy. Well, you're not a footballer anymore, and all of a sudden no one cares because you're not a footballer. Who are you? It took years to process all that and work through all that and you know, and everything else. Mm. But it was an amazing early lesson in that I will never let myself be defined by the business I own, the job I have, the past career I once had, any of those sort of things, because they're fleeting, you know, and it's the character, it's the integrity, it's the substance of who you are that's the stuff that is continually underlying for me, happiness and contentment and, you know, whatever else comes my way.
When you went into the AFL, so first Adelaide Crows and then St Kilda, what was driving you at that time to go into a professional sports career?
I don't know. That's what you wanted to do when you were 16, you know? Like, I don't know really what was driving me outside of, like, playing football, you know? I certainly liked training for football. Games I liked sometimes, but could never admit it at the time. But
what couldn't you admit there? That you should have loved the game, but the training was more appealing? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. You know, I used to wake up on a Saturday morning to play and go, oh, I've got to play today. You know, like, that used to happen all the time. And it was always something I sort of battled with. I kind of never really processed it at the time necessarily because I didn't really know any different. It was the way it was. But then I looked around and people were bouncing out of the bed ready to play footy, you know. Like, it's all about the game and the combativeness. And I much prefer the strategy of the game. I much prefer the ability to train for something, the team dynamic of all of that, the full back versus full forward sort of battle the whole time and all that sort of stuff. At times, you know, I enjoyed, especially when the sun was out and the ground was hard and everything was going all right, but in the middle of July when it's raining and cold and, you know, there's two blokes playing on you, it was much less enjoyable. You know, footy was an interesting dynamic for me, but it was always something I wanted to do. And at the end of my 17th year, or halfway through my 17th year, when I was 17 years old, they call them bottom age when you come through the draft. It's top age and bottom age. And I was basically told that I was too slow to get drafted. And, you know, I could read the play well, I could catch it, I could kick it, those sort of things. But I really wasn't good enough because my agility was no good and my speed was no good. So I played the last game of the year against Gippsland. I was playing for the Sandringham Dragons, played against Gippsland, and the next day started sprint training with a bunch of, you know, stall gift guys, and that's what, pulling sleds at Dendy Park and that sort of stuff, and trained pretty much every day until the season when I was, you know, all Australian and Vic Metro and went pick 14 to the Crows. So it was just a, you know, a true determination to get where I wanted to get, really. And being a professional footballer was great fun. The lifestyle was very good. The injuries and all the other bits and pieces weren't necessarily great, but yeah, it was where I wanted to be.
I think you've answered part of the question there, in that what was driving you was, it sounds like the camaraderie and the belonging was an important part of it for you in the training process.
Yeah, it was. I think that's one of the great things about football. I also love high performance. You know, like I can't do anything by halves. So the connection to high performance, mm-hmm. to being the absolute
best
you can be, not overly driven by the being the best, but the best I can be, or giving it my all at every opportunity, that fitted pretty well with my personality.
So then the AFL dream ends due to injuries, and you've said it was one of the greatest learning experiences of your life. What tools, what strategies did you add to your kit at that time that helped you cope with that transition?
The outside of the obvious stuff around, you know, discipline and hard work and all those sort of things, it gave me a bit of a clean slate. And I think I was lucky in many ways, because I had so many injuries in the last 2 years. Like, I had 12 or 13 operations in 18 months, and, you know, I was just over it. Like, I broke my jaw in my very last game of professional football, and, like, broke the jaw in two places on the side. I had screws and plates and everything else put in there as everyone else was going off in the Mad Monday stuff. And then the next week, you know, I had another operation on my ankle, and then, you know, walked in to get the sack from the coach on crutches with a massively swollen face. And, you know, it was like, well, are there any questions? No. Are we done? Yes. See ya, you know. And so I was just very over it and ready to go somewhere next. But so then I got a job at an advertising agency, and then sort of things went from there. But this point around failure, around it being okay to fail, you know, I learned that very early and quite publicly. Mm-hmm. And that was an incredible lesson for me for the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm. And at 22, so this is, how old are you when you're finishing up with the AFL? You're about
22.
22, okay. And so then you founded Bastion.
Yeah.
At that age, which is now Australasia's largest independent marketing and communications agency,
mm-hmm.
Employing 300, I'll just like sing the high notes for you, employing 300 staff around the globe. I mean, how did you do that? You were going in without experience. Talk to us about the early days of starting Bastion.
Yeah, I had no experience. I didn't know anything about anything. So there was absolutely no, like, long-term strategy or any of that sort of stuff. The reality was, I worked in an advertising agency for 6 months, and because they wore T-shirts and music was playing, and it seemed more fun than other stuff. And then sort of did that, and then kind of got to a point where I was like, I don't really want to work for anyone else, but I don't know what to do, you know. And so I came to the conclusion that I could find people who knew how to do something, because I knew how to do nothing. So if I didn't know how to do anything, then if I was going to start a business, I need to know people who had a skill, right? And that skill was the only thing I had experience in, was the marketing world. And so, you know, went and partnered with someone who had digital marketing skills, right? And so I could then go and sell digital marketing services, and they could go and deliver it. And I would sell that by going and sitting down with business owners or business leaders and asking them what their problems were. You know, I would facilitate them in many ways. It's just the stuff I learned to reach as a reach facilitator, and I'd be able to ask some questions and get to the core issue of what was really bothering them. And I'd say, okay, well, if we can solve that for you, would that be of interest to you? And they say yes. I say, okay, we'll go back, and then I'll go back to my guys who know what they're talking about, and I'll say, you know, here's the problem we need to solve. Can we solve this? And you know, and if the guy I had didn't know how to do it, I'd find another guy that did know how to do it, you know? And that was kind of the premise of how it all began. Then the idea was that we could find complementary services of those that sort of worked together to provide a better solution. Because you need a particular solution. You have a business problem that requires multiple services to solve. So I just was never comfortable saying, oh, well, we can do this bit for you, but not the other stuff. So then we, you know, sort of tacked on these different services. And, you know, now we're a fully integrated marketing services network that has, in this country, in Australia, basically every different service you can imagine from a marketing perspective, and some in New Zealand and growing in America to provide this sort of integrated solution.
And what's your role there now, Fergus?
I am the chairman and still own the company with the partners. So I chair it. I'm non-exec. I sort of sit over my brother. I've been very lucky that my brother's been my partner for – he came in about 2 years in. He started the sponsorship division of Bastion. And he just bit by bit has taken over, and he now runs the whole thing, and he is a much better CEO than I ever was, and he oversees it and runs it and does a brilliant job. And I sort of kind of take a more bird's eye view from a chairman perspective and provide different insights from there.
About 6 months ago, you took on the role of CEO at Reach.
Mm-hmm.
What led you to that? We know that you've got a decade's history with them, first as a participant, then as a crew member. And you've been involved on and off throughout the years.
Yeah. So I sat on the board for the last 2 years. And about 2 years ago was when I transitioned out of being the CEO of Bastion to the chairman. Right. So I went to Jack, my brother, and I said, look, this thing's like my skill set's taking it from small to medium. He's much more he's better at running a larger company, better at running larger 300 people, or it's a different skill set. So I said to him, It's time. Like, I've done my race here. It's been 12 years or whatever it was, and it's time you took over. So we did a transition and all that sort of stuff. And then I got involved in a couple of other businesses and did some other stuff. And then I was sort of looking at what was next, you know, and I didn't really know exactly what that was. Looked at a bunch of stuff. Nothing really grabbed me necessarily. Plenty of big, sexy opportunities and, you know, all that sort of stuff that on the surface is great, but it comes back to that. It's like, where's the substance, you know? And then the opportunity at Reach sort of came up, and that was it. It sort of just felt right. And, 6 months in, it's great, and we're doing some great stuff, and I'm loving it.
You've come into, I mean, they're lucky to have you in the organisation. It's brilliant. And knowing some of the programs in the past, I've sort of engaged with some of the programs, and it's an incredible organisation. You've come into it at a time when, of course, we know there's a tsunami of mental health crises, unfortunately, facing our young people, partly pandemic related, and then perhaps where the world's at. How is Reach, and can you talk to us, for those who don't know much about Reach work, how does Reach address that and work with young people to support them?
So Reach is a preventative mental health organisation primarily, right? So what we do is we run facilitated workshops in schools or in the community to sort of tackle two major things, and that is a better understanding of yourself and a better understanding of those around them. It's as simple as that. We do that through facilitated workshops where young people can talk about real stuff, what's really going on for them, what's really happening, and they can start to share and be honest. And they do that in a group setting, and by doing it in a group setting, they then go, oh, you're feeling how I'm feeling, and oh, I didn't know that about that person, and oh, God, I was thinking that as well. And they feel more connected to those around them. And if we can achieve those two things, at Reach, we talk about a 2-degree shift, right? Like, we're here to create just a 2-degree shift in a young person's mind where they feel a little bit more confident about themselves, they understand themselves a little bit better, and they understand the world around them a little bit more. And the best way to think about that is a rocket ship launching off into outer space. If you change the launch degree of a rocket ship by 2 degrees on the Earth, no one notices. But by the time it gets into outer space, it's 1,000 miles on a different path. And that's what we do, you know. So this mental health crisis, I'm a big believer that, yes, COVID was bad and all that sort of stuff. But COVID just showcased the fact that we didn't have overly well-equipped young people or adults from a mental health and mental strength perspective at the time. Now, that comes about because we didn't do the work 5 or 6 years ago. And so when these things happen, you know, and we're locked in our houses and all that sort of stuff, we, you know, we go through all the stuff we've all gone through, questioning ourselves, questioning our life direction, you know, and we make decisions like, well, we're going to go live in the country, or, you know, these sort of things that become surface level stuff, when really, if we'd have had better understanding of who we are, been able to self-evaluate, you know, more naturally, been able to understand our world around us better, because we did the work when we were 15 years old, would we have been better equipped to handle COVID? I would say probably.
So that level of self-examination, like one, you know, just fully being in touch with yourself, who you are, what you stand for, your relationship with yourself and the world. Yeah, which for a 15-year-old though is, you know, for young people, they're still emerging, aren't they? Like they're still developing and maturing, and there'd be few 15-year-olds who are fully resolved and know who they are, because of course they're still shaping.
And there'd be few 50-year-olds as well.
Yeah, exactly. There's no one, you know, it's a constant, we're constantly trying to figure it out. And that's why I'm so passionate about this stuff. Should just be part of the curriculum. You know, it should just be part of what we do at school, which is we do maths, we do English, we do physical education, we do music, you know, and we do self-awareness.
Mm. Well, there is more wellbeing curriculum coming in the personal, you know, development capabilities side of things. I mean, that's what I was going to ask you. How does reach more kids? Like at the moment, young people have to come to your programs and you do some school workshops, but in terms of embedding it in curriculum so you can get that scale, is there work that's been done around that?
Yeah, so the majority of what we do is in schools. So we go to schools, deliver the workshops in the classroom. Our ability to grow is a direct correlation between our ability to train facilitators. Right. So at its core, what we do is train facilitators, right? Mm-hmm. So we recruit them at 15. We train them up. We train them in the ability to hold a room, the ability to present, the ability to ask a question. We teach them about unsaids and hooks and cues and various other facilitation techniques. So then when they walk into a room with 60 year nines, they can sort of connect to them, you know, and they're young people working with young people, so they connect to them quite quickly. We run a range of activities that make them think about, you know, things like the mask they're wearing and the layers they put on around themselves and what they're doing to protect themselves on a daily basis versus acting from ego versus spirit, those sort of things. And then we get them in a position. Our facilitators then manage, you know, they run all of those sessions, they manage the energy in the room, and then they get to a point where they ask the relevant question at the relevant time to get people speaking about what's really going on, right? And so that's what we do. So for us to grow, it's get into more schools. Heroes Days is a product that we're growing. So we do 500 young people at a time, not 60. And we're doing for multiple school groups. And it's a pretty empowering, it's a very significant sort of product. But we're training more facilitators. And we have full-time professional facilitators that go and run a couple of workshops every day.
And it's just in Victoria, or are you working across?
We work nationally. We train out of Victoria. So our sort of training development program operates out of Victoria. We think is the best way to run the best training product, because the quality of the facilitation is the quality of the work. So we train everyone here locally, and then we, what I term, export the talent out. So we'll go to Sydney, we'll do 15 workshops in Sydney with two facilitators over a week, and then they'll fly home, you know. So we deliver nationally, we deliver in every state in the country in the last month.
One of the points of difference there that's really powerful is that it's young people working with young people, and we know that lived experience is informs learning in a different way than when you have a so-called expert stand at the front of a room, but you don't connect in that way. So I think that's one of the things that I've noticed and observed with Reach over the years, is that it's young people talking to young people, and young people who have a whole wealth of experiences themselves that they're vulnerable in sharing, which is that's how bridges are built, isn't it?
Exactly right. That's right. And the young people working with young people is really important because they connect quickly. If I was to walk into a school workshop with year nines and dressed how I dressed, listen to the music I listen to, it's like it'd take me an hour and a half just to kind of get them to lighten up, you know, or connect with them. These guys connect with them in 5 minutes. And that's a really important component. And nothing Reach does is presenting ideas, or like we don't present a message. There's no message we're trying to get across here. We just create a safe space for people to talk, you know, and ask them the right questions in an environment where they feel exceptionally comfortable and very well supported and everything else. That's what it's all about. So young people being able to work with other young people, and we recruit from an incredibly diverse background, right? Because we have to connect with every young person you know, out there. And we have, you know, people from all different backgrounds, all different walks of life that can ultimately walk into any school. We've co-facilitated, so we can, you know, we like to think between the two facilitators we can connect with most of the room. And that goes a long way to delivering good work.
With the model you're using, then if you do connect with a young person who's at risk or you know, comes into that safe space, and then there is that moment where they, you know, they can then talk about what's going on for them. How do you also work with families? Because then, of course, these young people go back into a family environment of some sort. There's a piece there, isn't there, around educating families as well, around understanding the lived experience of a young person in the world right now?
There is. So we've got a program called Turning Tides where parents and young people work together. We have a program called Thousand Faces where adults and young people work together. And then we have a program called Finding Heroes, which is about training the teachers, basically, right? And again, all things that we need to be doing more of and sort of diversifying and our distribution and how we get that out there is a big part of it. But we call it the reach ripple, right? It's multiple ways to get more opportunity for more young people to be able to feel comfortable in sharing who they are, talking about what's going on for them at a time, like you mentioned before, where their brain's developing and they're trying to figure out their place in the world and they're, you know, asking a girl out for the first time and they're failing exams or they're passing exams or they're, you know, it's like they're not getting picked for the footy team and the netball team. It's like all of this stuff that's going on at a time when they're trying to figure out who they are, and then we don't really give them an opportunity to talk about what's really happening for them. And it's just such an obvious missing piece of the puzzle that for whatever reason – as a society, we just don't focus on.
I think it's an obvious missing piece of the puzzle across the lifespan. Your work is beautifully focused on youth, but you don't turn 21 or 25 or 30 or 35 or 40 or 100 and have arrived with answers to these questions and settled with your vulnerabilities.
So we have a program called WAKE, which works in corporate Australia, right? So we work with, I don't know, a bunch of big brands doing their human connection work, team building, stuff like that. Now, we rate, you know, in all the evaluations and everything else, at the highest of high ends when it comes to corporate engagement, team building, productivity increase, low reduction in turnover, all the things from that perspective. And the work is pretty much the same, you know, and because we're not going in there as corporate people and culture consultants. You know, with all these matrixes and all the other stuff that happens in that world, we go in and say, let's just be real. Let's connect with each other on a real basis. You know, let's shed a few tears. Let's have some laughs. Let's connect with each other this way. And what happens then? Well, we build stronger teams and we build greater connection and fast track team connection and team unity and those sort of things. And, the outcome is great because unless you're going to go see a psychologist one-on-one, you just don't get this opportunity, you know. You don't get it. And you know, I used to get it in team sport, but once you turn 30 and you have kids, you don't play team sport anymore. You know, it's like these things start to go away.
Yeah, and obviously the pandemic, you know, it's been a complex time the last couple of years around teams feeling connected because we've all been so dislocated and shut in our homes, in our lives. And I suppose, it comes back to that basic thing of being heard, talking about real stuff, showing up as a human at work, not just a worker with some sort of carapace or coat on around who you really are.
Totally.
Which is so, so powerful and so important, and yet we forget that so much in workplaces, that we're humans first.
We used to do this activity in the early days of starting Bastion, and we did it because we moved into an office 10 years ago at least near Richmond Station. So we had our staff, however many staff, we had 30 maybe at the time, and we got them all to get on different trains in the morning. So meet at different stations, all coming into Richmond Station in groups of five or six. And get on, and the rule was you had to get on your own carriage by yourself and you had to not talk and you just had to look at everyone. Look at everyone's faces, look at their demeanour, look at their mannerisms. And then everyone, you know, comes to Richmond Station, they get off the train, we all have a session in the office and we say, well, what'd you see? Oh, my God, just like how just depressing it was, you know, how just like you look at people and the way they're acting and portraying themselves on the train at 7:30 in the morning to go to the place that they're going to spend the vast majority of their
lives
at, and they look like they couldn't. They wouldn't want to go. It would be the worst thing in the world to go where they're going, you know. And we used it as a cultural thing, saying, "Well, let's never let this company be like that." You know, let's be open, let's be honest, our number one value was make each other's lives better. That was the whole thing. And unfortunately, it's just the reality for a lot of people, you know, going to work. And if you can peel all that stuff back and have the depth of the human connection, everything gets better.
Hear. You are also, Fergus, a parent yourself. How old are your kids?
I have three kids. I've got a 3.5-year-old, a 2-year-old, and a 4-month-old baby.
Oh, wow. Goodness. All right. So you're talking about the business of prevention. I mean, you're probably not getting any sleep at the moment, let alone trying to prevent mental health crises in the world. What will you do differently now with your children that you may not have done if you hadn't had these insights and experiences across your life?
Oh, my wife and I were talking about that just the other day, because it's outside of the fact of just continually getting scared that I'm going to stuff them up or screw them up in some way.
Can I confirm that you will in some ways do that?
Everybody, I've stuffed up 4.
I've stuffed up 2, so that's 6. It is a given. We're saying it facetiously, but we do, as parents, do things that don't serve our children well.
Mm.
Full stop. And, oh, maybe comma or semicolon.
And
we also do things that serve them well.
Yeah. So I am a believer, as a young parent, it sort of ties into the reach stuff, is you need to make them feel heard. So I have sort of this ethos, I suppose, or belief that is my job, or mine and my wife's job, to create the opportunity for opportunity, right, is the thing that I keep banging on about. So that is, I need to make sure that if one of my kids wants to be a ballet dancer, the other one wants to be an accountant, the other one wants to be a stockbroker, and another one wants to be a farmer, they have equal opportunity, both from a position of being heard, being able to express that, being able to experience it, and being able to go and do whatever they want to do, right? But it's the opportunity for opportunity, because no one's going to do it for you. You just have equal opportunity to be whatever you want to be and do whatever you want to do and all that sort of stuff. So that is my job, as mine and my wife's job as the parents, is to ensure that we create that opportunity for our kids. Now, we do that through a number of ways, but from an emotional sort of self-development, sort of content perspective, our focus is making sure they feel heard, they feel non-judgment, they feel connected, and they feel safe. And they have a roof over their head and they're fed good food.
And safe to be who they are as they emerge into the young people they're going to be.
If we can do those things from an emotional contentment perspective, they feel loved, they feel connected, they feel heard, they feel not judged, they're healthy and they're warm. If we can do those things, and then the functional stuff around that, from our family network, all the different moving parts of building a family, connect those two together, my feeling is you got half a chance of producing healthy, happy kids. So that's kind of what we're focusing on.
We'll circle back with you in 15 years to see how that's gone. Tell us, for our listeners, and you've given some idea here, but is there anything else you can share with us about how people can support and be involved? We've got a mix of listeners, some who have, you know, a business mindset, others are parents, others are young people themselves. How can people get involved?
So the website is reach.org.au. You can go to that, and there's a handful of ways. You can donate money. That always helps. That's great. You can come to different events. So we have a ball coming up. We have our breakfast every year. We have those sort of things. We have various different campaigns that are fundraising campaigns and stuff like that. So you can get involved from that perspective. What we're really big on is sustainable business model. A sustainable business model. So, you know, if you're a business owner or you run a team, you can control a budget, hire our WAKE team to deliver work. If every corporate in this country hired Reach to run connection work for leading into Christmas, or evaluation on the things we've achieved this year, or an ability to create teams that are emotionally connected to each other leading into the Christmas break. If everyone did that, Reach would be in a very, very strong position, because we'd be facilitating consistent, sustainable work from that perspective. So hire us to do that work.
Which then allows you to train your young facilitators to do their work.
Correct, yeah.
That's the funding model?
Yes, it is, but we also have great corporate partnerships. So, again, if you're a corporate out there looking to connect with young people, if you're a brand looking to sell stuff to young people, sell stuff to parents, sell stuff to teachers, get in touch with us, because we can promote, you can sponsor us, and we can promote your organisation through a sort of cross-branded integration sort of from a marketing perspective as well. So our funding model is we're self-sustainable from a service perspective. Wake corporate work is higher margin than school work, right? So we kind of top up the coffers a little bit from that perspective. And community work is very low margin, if not loss making. So the work we give away to low socioeconomic communities and stuff like that. So, but that is all ultimately self-sustaining. And then our corporate partnerships and our fundraising and sort of philanthropic donations, that allows us to invest in the future. So that allows us to put on more facilitators on full-time contract ahead of schedule. You know, it allows us to invest in broadening out our Heroes Day product. It allows us to invest in various other things that can fast track the future development of the organisation, rather than what most charities have, unfortunately, which is I need to raise the money now to keep the lights on now. Mm. Private enterprise doesn't have that. Private enterprise has capital injections, it has, you know, capital raising, it invests in the future, it does all these sort of things, and that the not-for-profit world doesn't often have.
Yeah, well, and also just compound the impact, the incredible impact that you've been having across Australia. So we look forward to you continuing to increase the reach of Reach, and we'll put some links in the show notes to some of those programs. We always like to end our chats with people asking one final question, and that is, who do you think is doing human well?
Oh, that is a good question. Who's doing human well? I like Barack Obama. He seems real to me. He seems connected. He seems real. He seems a good combination of family man, leader. I think that's hard as a leader to stay the course. You know, leadership is lonely. Leadership is exposing. You are very much on your own as a leader. And he always strikes me as someone who is doing that well whilst having what seems to be a beautiful, loving relationship with his wife and his kids, and the combination of that seems to work as a sort of happy household. So he's probably my answer.
And we don't usually ask a follow-up answer, but I have got one. That's usually our final question. But you're a leader. How are you doing on being alone at the top?
It's a good question. I have good days and bad days with it. It's with the kids, how young the kids are and how hectic our life is, you don't get a huge amount of time to feel alone from that perspective, you know. I struggle with it because you don't get positive feedback all that often, right? You generally get – if it's big, look how great – it's a big, like, purposeful thing, then people will tell you, you know, that's good and nice job. Most of the time what you get is this is going wrong, that's going wrong, this is no good, that's no good, this person said that. That's most of the time. So I struggle with all that stuff. I really do, because you put your heart and soul into doing something significant, and that's the stuff you hear most of the time. But I've also been doing – I've been a CEO since I was 22. So – that's 14 years. I'm 36 now, 37 next week. It's like I kind of don't know any different as well. So I've had a lot of practice at a young age, which I think has been beneficial for me.
Mm. Well, keep doing your good work. The world needs you too.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Great to chat today.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks, Fergus. Thank Cheers. You. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Human Cogs. We hope that this conversation has led you to think a little bit differently about yourself and those around you.
And thank you for all the amazing feedback that we get about these conversations. If you do like Human Cogs and what we're doing, we would love you to hit subscribe and please leave us a star rating. What that means is we can keep bringing you more stories from extraordinary ordinaries to help us all
do human well.